Hello, human peoples. You're listening to the podcast network of Gamefully Unemployed. Support us and gain access to great exclusive podcasts like Fox Mulder is a Maniac, Tom and Jeff Watch Batman, Star Trek The Next Futurama, and our latest show, Spiel Boys. Head over to patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. We do game streaming, movie nights with our patrons every Friday night, and you can even commission your own podcast about anything you want. Literally anything, within reason, and we have to do it. You are quite frankly out of excuses not to go visit patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. That's patreon.com/gamefully unemployed, which is spelled like it sounds.
Spice.
It's the spice!
Oh, we love the spice. Hi, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
My name is David Bell.
My name is Tom Ryman.
And we just watched Dune 2 Cruise Control.
Dune, right? 2, Dune Harder.
Dune Harder. Dune 2, Hell on Earth.
Yeah, right? That's one. That's one.
Like the Dooms. Why? They should have went with Dunes.
Dune
Aliens,
2, Judgment
shit.
Day.
Yeah. Yeah, I like mine.
Yeah, no, Dunes should have been it. Yeah. Because
there are Dunes.
There's multiple Dunes. There's more than one out there.
You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Look!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes and great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
There's way more.
It's a whole planet, Arrakis. Desert planet. It's a reference to the Lynch version.
Yeah. I wish I rewatched that and prep for this. In fact, I wish I watched Dune Part 1 and prep for this.
Although I did. That's a major thing. This movie...
I wasn't that lost.
I will say, before we get into it, in terms of just how you should... This movie... It really does help to watch them one right after the other, because it really is just one long movie. Like, this movie picks up immediately where the last one ends.
So we're in it. We're in it. I saw this in IMAX at Universal, which was nice.
Ooh.
Real big ass screen. This was a delight. Like, you like this, right? You like Dune 2?
Yeah, I like Dune 2 a lot. There's some, I think overall, I think the first one is better, honestly.
But
this, because there's some jankiness in this movie, like they still can't figure out how much information is in Dune, because there's some editing jankiness in this movie. The one criticism I have is that this movie frequently jumps geography and time, huge jumps, with not much indication. So the editing is kind of all over the place in some parts of the movie just to get information across. So it feels a little jumbled and confused at some points.
I didn't mind that too much, but I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's not fair because I haven't watched the first Dune, but I feel like I actually liked this one more, and for a very superficial reason. I'm not a huge Dune head, right? I know you're more of a Dune fan than me.
Yeah, but I wouldn't even call myself a Dune head. It's just I grew up enjoying the David Lynch version. I liked the first one. I like this one. I like big...
I like them all. Yeah.
I like super serious space operas.
Yeah. I think I like this more because this just had more action.
It did.
Which
more,
is silly to
happens.
Say.
A lot happens. This movie is almost all plot, which is part of the reason for some of the dizzying edits.
Yes. I didn't know, like, they're clearly teasing a third, and I didn't even know there would be a third. I thought
it was
just
me
a
either.
Two.
I thought they were going to... This ends where the first book ends, as I understand it.
And
I knew that they were talking about doing some of the other novels in the series, but I didn't expect it to end with... It's not necessarily... It's
kind
not
of a cliffhanger.
It's not really a cliffhanger, but it's
It could...
It definitely ends with, there is more to this story to be told. I did not expect that. Like, it ends like we're going to immediately pick up with Dune 3.
Yeah, it's more that it ends in a way that this could be it, right? And that's okay, but... You would probably walk out of this, which I did. Which
you'd be bummed if this was the last one. Yeah.
I'd be like, that was conclusive, but it was also sad because it's not conclusive with the characters.
No, it's very much a part two. It's very much an Empire Strikes Back. Like, it's real dark. They go really
dark.
to the darkness of what I understand the novels explore this. I don't know for certain, so I know there's probably plenty of Frank Herbert fans that are listening and gnashing their teeth at me, so please correct me in comments or on social media. But my understanding is part of the conflict of the Dune series is the fact that Paul Atreides becomes this messianic figure that is like, you know, like in this movie, he's wrestling with, and in the first one too, but the idea that he's eventually going to be the cause of these brutal holy wars that are going to claim billions of lives, and he doesn't want to be that. But he eventually embraces it in this film because he sort of convinces himself that it's the only way to get what he wants, which makes his character really interesting, but also really dark.
It's also that part I felt I was the most rushed.
I just wanted to end that thought real quick. I believe that's where the novels go. I'm not certain, so I'm so sorry if I'm wrong, Dune fans. But Dune fans. It does. This movie leads into like the overarching Dune universe in a way that the Lynch version, like the Lynch version, ends with a very corny, like he brings rain to Arrakis, and it just ends like a fantasy movie ends, and that's it. This movie ends where it's like the story is clearly not finished. Like it ends with Paul about to go to war with all of the great houses of the universe.
Right. And I see why the Lynch version, like, people would feel, you know, like, wow, he just sort of wrapped up the whole thing in one film. My big hot take, though, on Dune and Dune Part 2 is that I think it could have been one movie, to be honest. Like, I'm not saying it should have been.
It's kind of just season one of Game of Thrones, though. It really is just like the end of this one conflict, but it's the beginning of a huge broader conflict.
Right. It's more that Dune, it's more about part one, where I thought about, like, so part one, correct me if I'm wrong, is it's Paul, you know, he's like, he's a fancy boy. He's getting ready to rule. His family is attacked. Boy. Yeah, his family's attacked. He's cast out into the desert. He meets these rebels, the people who are actually, they actually belong there. And then he fights one of them, and they accept him. And that's kind of it. And then we, like you said, we pick off where they left off, where it's like his training, which to me seems like Act 2 of a movie.
Correct.
Like that first movie is entirely in Act 1, which is like...
In point of fact, it is Act 1 of the Lynch movie.
Exactly. It is Act 1 of any story, and they just sort of stretched it to a whole movie. And then we're getting Acts 2 and 3, basically, in this, which... I get why they did it because there's a lot of information, and I'm not going to say they shouldn't have done it because clearly it worked. Like everybody watched
this movie, made 87 million at least domestically. Like it's doing well. It's doing well. Right. People like Dune, which I kept having that thought watching this movie yesterday in a crowded theater at 12:30. Crowded theater. And it's just most of this movie is people droning on and on about Dune lore. And it's just a theater full of people silently, enrapturously watching this fucking gobbledygook.
I was like, cheering.
Dune is really working on people.
Yeah, people were like, yeah, Dune. Well,
I think it's a lot of things. I think it's we're all at this day in 2024, you know, people of the generation that's adults now all grew up on like anime. And I think it's people are just more... Nerd shit is more mainstream now. Like in-depth nerd shit is just more mainstream. It was always kind of mainstream, but like after Lord of the Rings and Marvel movies and D&D being mainstream now, it's just... And Game of Thrones. I can't say Game of Thrones enough because Dune is just literally Game of Thrones. I know... I don't know, but I am fairly certain that George R.R. Martin borrowed heavily from Dune for Game of Thrones. It just seems like people have more of an appetite, more patience, and just get more out of this kind of fantasy story now, where it's a lot about intrigue, it's a lot about maneuvering and positioning, and it's less about the big battles.
Yes, but I also think there is something, because I was thinking about that too, is like, why is Dune a hit?
Just people fucking are into Dune. I don't understand it. I do not understand. I love it because I love Dune. It's a weird fucking crazy ass thing for people to be into.
So I think there's something to be said. Never underestimate the power of simply good filmmaking. And what I mean by that is that you look at, like, I don't want to compare this to anything. I don't like comparing things, but you look at a movie like Rebel Moon that came out. Rebel Moon is essentially a bunch of sci-fi horse shit that's being said in a very monotone, serious way by people. It's no, on paper, it's no different than Dune, right? But you look at things like the final fight in Rebel Moon, if you recall, versus Dune.
Not a bad final fight.
Well, it's so loud, right? It's like we're on this big set piece. It's very like, you know, we're blasting music. We're doing these slow-mo shots. It just feels like when you compare that to like this final fight in Dune, which is this fight is so raw and there's no music.
It happens so abruptly that you don't even realize it's the final fight.
And it's hinging on these characters. Like the last shot of this movie is a character's face. Whereas like, I think when you look at like something like Rebel Moon again, it's like they love all this lore and they want to share this lore. But like they're not thinking about the people. Another good comparison.
They're not thinking about they love the world, but they're not thinking about the characters that inhabit it. I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah. A movie that's kind of in between, I would argue, is like the Lucas prequels. Like if you look at that last fight between Anakin and Obi-Wan, another fight I was thinking of, which is like there are some genuinely emotional moments.
That is a good fight. Like people talk shit about it, and I know there's a lot of like unnecessary frills to it, but it's a very emotional fight.
That's what I was gonna say, is that ending when he's like, I loved you. Had that scene not been in there, I don't think that fight would have been regarded as
it's not even just that he says, yeah, I love you. Were, what did he say? You were the chosen one. I loved you. Yeah. And then it's Anakin. He's all burned. He says, I hate you. And he's screaming it and he's crying. As the prequels are, and they are, that moment that's emotion. They understood the emotion of that climactic fight.
You could have put that fight in a room and with nothing like this Dune fight.
They didn't need to fight on a lava planet. It could be two guys fighting in an office with a switchblade with the same emotional heights, and it would have hit as hard.
Yeah, which is all to say that the reason we remember certain things like that scene, which is tons of spectacle, but not like Rebel Moon. I would also argue the spectacle in Rebel Moon is very, I don't know, it's very derivative in general.
It's Xeroxed. It's a copy of a copy of a copy. It didn't have the... You were the best of us. You were the chosen one. I loved you. I hate you. It doesn't have that moment.
It doesn't
anywhere
have any
in that movie.
Characters, yeah. Like emotional attachment. And so, like Dune, I think part of the reason people are genuinely like, you know, what got the biggest gasp in my theater is when he with the other chick. He's like, I'll take you as my wife or whatever. And like,
really, because he
like,
said that two scenes before. Like that scene is when Chani hears it. That's when Zendaya
hears it.
We heard it like two or three scenes
before.
We
heard it.
We
people
already
are gasping.
Knew he was going to take the Emperor's daughter as his wife.
That's, I think because the audience genuinely
didn't think
are
he was
so
gonna
used
go through
to
with it.
Exactly. They're so used to other movies where it's like that's the setup, right? Is
but
the hero
I,
then
I
takes
do
it back.
Say, I do want to say I think that's intentional. I think it's part of the filmmaking that Denis Villeneuve does in this movie. Like he does the slow corruption of Paul. Like he gives Paul to us as a heroic figure. He's he's saying all the right things. I don't want to go to the South with the fanatics because they're going to think I'm the Messiah, and that's bad. Even if it helps us, even if it means that they will die for our cause without thinking about it, I can't be responsible for that. I can't have that on me.
Right.
And as the movie progresses, he just eventually goes south because he's like, well, it's the only way to get what we all want. Like, I'm doing this to free the Fremen, right? You guys want this. You guys want to own Dune. You guys want to run your own planet, right? And this gets me what I want. It gets me revenge against the Harkonnen. So I'm going to go down to, you know what? I am going to go down to the South and be their Messiah.
Like, meanwhile, so his mom is just like, let's do this, Grift. Come on, motherfucker.
Fucking, I love Rebecca Ferguson in this. Yeah. She is so fucking sinister.
She really is.
She's just like running shit as soon as she's installed. And like, the movie lets you forget about it a little bit. Like people will try to fuck with her and then she'll either use her mind control voice, which is creepy as hell.
I love that voice.
It's such a good effect. It's so, Anyway, it's such a good effect. The way that they do the mixing, where they put this bass mix in with, she's just doing a creepy voice like this, but they're also doing a sound mix and emphasizing it so it sounds like this force that's hitting you.
I love with this idea.
And then also she's just like a Billy badass. Like she can cut necks with the best solid snake. So like every time somebody fucking forgets who Jessica is in this movie, she reminds them.
Yes. I love that it's also kind of a grift, even though she's magical. Like this, like that's what's amazing about it is like, they're like, you're the chosen one. They're like, you're magical. And it's like, well, I am magical, just not in the way that you think I am. Like I have, it reminds me of like, there's a Star Trek episode with a time traveler who turns out to be a grifter where it's like, he can still time travel.
It's Matt Frewer,
yeah.
Right?
He can still time travel, but he's also a liar.
It's Booster like, Gold, right? It's the DC Comics character where he is from the future and he does have superior technology. It's just, he's lying about who he is. But yeah, they do that. And
talking about how good Rebecca Ferguson is in this, which is great. We're talking about his journey as well, as like him going to the South, not wanting it at first, and then him slowly embracing this idea, and like then he starts kind of liking it. By the end, he's like kind of liking it. Like, it's that idea,
He's making a show of not liking it, but it's like, it seems like you like it. And so that's why it ends with a person's face. It ends on Chani's face, on Zendaya's face, because she's more or less the audience proxy, kind of. Like, she's our, like, moral compass. Like, we kind of look to her to see how we should be feeling about shit in this movie.
Right, and she
is not happy about Paul doing this.
Right, she's unconditionally like, this prophecy is bullshit. Nobody believe it.
She candidly and specifically says messianic prophecies are designed to keep people subjugated, because the one true thing, you know, apart from being the son of God, what's the one true thing from all messianic prophecies? They make you sit and wait for the Messiah to come back. And so she's like, these prophecies just make us complacent. They just make us cattle. They just make us sit and wait for centuries and endure anything, any kind of hardship, because we know the Messiah is coming. You will endure any hardship if you believe the Messiah is coming.
Right. And like, the prophecy is literally like white savior. It's an outsider.
It is just a white savior.
Outsider will save us.
And I like that this
and
movie
she's like,
is like,
this is bullshit.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I like her journey is very difficult, and I think they did a good job with it, because they first...
She wound up being a much more compelling character than I expected, because in the David Lynch movie, this is Sean Young's character, and she is basically a non-character. She just is there to be a love interest for Kyle MacLachlan and just agrees with everything he does.
Well, this one, that's what's interesting. With this film, for a while, I was like, I feel like they're almost wasting her as a love interest. Like in the first movie, I didn't know.
She's barely in.
Reason this movie ends on her face is, I think, to signify, like, meet your new protagonist.
She's the protagonist.
Like, that's who's actually this movie or this story is about. But, like, they have to, I think they navigated it pretty well, because at first she follows Paul, and it's when Paul is like, she's right. This is bullshit. We're doing a grift. It's not a real prophecy.
Yeah, I don't want to, just to interrupt you real quickly, and I don't want to hit Game of Thrones too many more times, but he's Daenerys.
Yes, he's Daenerys. Continue. And I think, like Daenerys, they have a little bit of a problem with his turn. So it's more like it's his relationship with her, because there's a period of this film where he just sort of stops talking to her. It's like during the part where he has to make this turn, and then he goes back to her and he's like, I'll love you forever or whatever. But like,
I love it until I stop breathing.
Yeah, they do a good job with her in that period, which is that she starts having a relationship with Josh Brolin, who they bring in like kind of as a coincidence. It's like they just run into each other
desert. It's how it happens in the Lynch version, too. He just runs into Patrick Stewart in the desert.
It's like weird, but okay. But he sort of he's the one who's then telling her, like, listen, I know it's bullshit too, but we're like kind of using this. Like, you have to use this. You have to ride this. It's sort of this moment where she almost puts her faith in Paul of like, he will veer away at the last minute, and he doesn't.
He won't. Yeah.
And she's like, all right, fuck it. I'm taking the first worm out of here.
We experience that the all of that through her eyes. Like, the second half of the movie is almost entirely through Chani's eyes.
Right.
Stealthily, you don't really notice it. But like I said, like, she's the character that we're looking to her to see how we're supposed to feel about all this stuff. And as Paul gets deeper and deeper into the fanaticism and courting religious zealotry in order to get what he wants, which is, like, he wants a good thing. Like, he wants to give the Fremen the control of Arrakis because it's their planet. And he wants to avenge the unjust murder of his father, which was done. It was a crime. Like, it is a crime. Like, it's another thing that's going, that is going on in this movie, is that in the first movie, when the Emperor sent his little personal band, his personal army, to help the Harkonnens kill the House Atreides, that's a crime. You can't do that.
No, you can't do that.
But that's, it all happened crime. In a night, and nobody, there were no witnesses except for Paul himself. That's why Paul himself is a problem.
Right.
So, like, you want him to, like, stick it to the Emperor, who is Christopher Walken as fuck.
Yeah, he is. He's great.
Christopher Walken in space, which is the best place to put Christopher Walken.
Oh, yeah. It's where he belongs.
It's where he belongs. But he actually does a good performance in this movie. I mean,
he's great.
Actually, like, he's fucking Deer Hunter. He's incredible. Not that Christopher Walken is a bad
actor. I know what you mean, which is that he's an older man. He doesn't give a fuck. Like,
he doesn't do what... Christopher Walken also, like, he's aware of himself. Like, he knows what the meme is. So he'll lean into the Christopher Walken-ness of it. He doesn't do that in this movie. He's giving a genuine performance in this film.
Yeah, subtle performance.
It's very subtle.
Yeah.
Especially when he kisses the ring at the end, it's so fucking good. Just just the lightest touch of his lips, but it's going, such a fucking brutal moment.
Going back to about the perspective, it occurred to me, the last shot of this movie is of her face. Remember what the first shot of the movie is? It's of his face.
His face, yeah.
And, like, I think rewatching this, I think it's shift in perspective.
From what he wants to what she wants.
It's switching the protagonist. I think if you rewatch this movie with that in mind, I bet it very subtly in the cinematography and scenes before, like, that's the realization.
You're right.
100% swap protagonists throughout the film. You just, like, it's such a gradual thing that, like, I can't even remember the exact moment it happened. It just slowly became her story.
The editing helps that, too. The janky editing helps that, because a lot of what the janky editing cuts out is, like, the interstitial stuff between, like, Paul and Jessica and Gurney. So it's confining us to an outsider's viewpoint. I don't think it's entirely intentional. This is me giving the movie some credit.
I think it might be, actually.
I think it's partially intentional, but I also think it was just for time. Like, there was some sloppiness in it.
Oh, you mean the editing?
Yeah. I'm talking about the editing.
Sorry, the change of perspective.
Change of perspective is 100% intentional, yes.
It explains why I was saying earlier, like, I felt like his change was more abrupt than hers. It's because they were swapping it. Like, they weren't giving us his perspective as much.
We already kind of know, like, the first chunk of the movie is so wrapped up in how tormented he is by this idea that he is going to bring this holy war, and he just doesn't want it. He doesn't want to. But the first movie ends with him getting a vision wrong, which becomes a huge through line throughout Dune 2, part 2. It's his relationship with Jami or Jamis.
Ask me to know any
The guy
names.
He kills at the end of the first movie. Like, if you recall, as they're approaching, when they're going to crash land in the desert and meet the Fremen, Paul starts having visions of this man. Jamis, I think, is his name. It's the guy that he kills in the end of Dune Part 1.
Right.
And he has visions of this man, like, he's like, I'm going to teach you the ways of the desert. Like, he has visions of this guy showing him how to survive in the desert, giving him his knife, showing him how to ride sandworms. And then when he gets to the Fremen camp, he meets this man that has been his mentor friend in all these visions. But when he meets him, this man hates him. He's like, this guy is an outsider. Fuck him. And invokes this tribal right of fighting basically Paul to the death, and Paul has to kill him. So none of the visions he had about this man and their friendship and this man imparting his wisdom onto him came true. So that's when, at the end of the first movie, that's when Paul has his first inkling of like, oh, fuck, my visions aren't set in stone. Like, the things that
like
I see
timelines
don't
that could
have
happen.
To happen. But so that's how the first movie ends. But the second movie begins with him wrestling with this vision that he has of him bringing a holy war on, and he can't get past it. And he continues to have visions of Jameis throughout the movie. And it's just, it's interesting to have that split between the two movies, because this movie moves to Chani's perspective, where it's like, it's basically we've lost Paul to obsession, is what it right. feels like. It's because we know that Paul can work out the way that his visions work. Like, we know that he knows they're not all set in stone. Like, he's just seeing possible futures. And in fact, he says that specifically in this movie. He's like, I've seen our enemies all around us. He basically does the Doctor Strange thing where he's like, I've seen this war that we're about to do play out 100 different ways. There's like one way we can do this, and this is the way we're about. This is what we're going to do.
Right.
So we already know that he's seen a bunch of different visions, and he understands that not all of them are set in stone. But for whatever reason, he is convinced by this vision of him going to the south and starting this famine and this devastating holy war that it becomes his obsession, and it becomes every decision he makes in Dune 2 is based on his fear that he is going to start a holy war as a messiah.
Right.
And it's very subtle, but they set it up in Dune 1 because Dune 1 takes its time. That's why I think it's the better movie. Even though some of the characters are pretty flat in the first one, because we don't really get the full breadth of their motivation until this
Dune
movie.
One, it was easier to tune that movie out as you're watching it. Like, that was my complaint about Dune 1 is that I loved being in it. I love the vibes. I love the filmmaking. It's
so
just
good.
It's easier for that movie to kind of wash over me.
Yeah.
In a way where I finish it and go like, I didn't quite retain this movie. I really enjoyed it, but I didn't retain it as much as this one. If that makes sense.
No,
they're
get
both
it.
Very good movies. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, I was just pointing that out, that the first one definitely sets up all of the characters and takes its time and lets you know.
Yeah.
And then in Dune 2, Paul's obsession is really the focus of the first like 40 minutes. And then it shifts to the other characters, and we don't check in with Paul as often, and you don't even really notice it's happening, like you said.
Yeah.
But it's like Paul becomes a supporting character, and then you realize, oh, he's not the main character. Oh, fuck, Chani's the main character. We're feeling what she's feeling. We're not checking in with Paul anymore, but we know his obsession. We haven't checked in with him in a while. Like, we know this thing is like sitting in his head and worrying away
right.
in his brain. So it's like the movie gives all of the seeds to like know what's happening with him, but it cuts you off of his perspective. I think it just does a good, you really need to watch both parts of this like back to back, I think.
I think that's the
experience.
Best way to watch this,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But like
it really is just
Paul.
Like a 5-hour movie.
I do love how they tie in this the concept of long-termism, the idea that he's now thinking in terms of like centuries.
He's
seems
Dr.
Like.
Manhattan. Yeah, he gets the Dr. Yeah. Manhattan thing where he can't bother himself with individual lives because he's thinking generations and centuries ahead.
Which turns him into an asshole.
Which turns him into an asshole, yeah.
Yeah, and not correct. I love whenever, because like Elon Musk is a long-termism guy, and it's like, well, look how well that's turning out. There's a really good Star Trek DS9 about that, where they have basically, you know Khan.
I know Khan. I'm aware of
genetically,
Khan.
In DS9, they have genetically engineered people who are kind of confined because of the Khan stuff. And they have an episode with them because they're like they're harmless. The idea is like you kind of feel like they're the victims, and they are. But they're fighting this Dominion War, and there's a great episode where they're so good at thinking that they're thinking centuries and centuries ahead, and decide that statistically the more lives would be saved if we surrender during this war. And so they like try to like get us to, and then you start, and then they realize like at the last minute, like, what the fuck are we doing? Like, it doesn't, like, they're thinking on this weird long-term statistical level that they're doing something monstrous in the moment, because they're like, in the end, like, this will be the better thing.
Exactly.
And that's sort of the vibe of Paul, where it's like, he's thinking
Paul's
so long-term.
Like, 3 centuries from now, the fact that I am pretending to be their messiah, and he knows he's pretending.
Yeah, and Johnny's like...
That's the thing I wanted to bring up earlier. There is a huge unspoken thing in Dune, and... When I say unspoken, it's just a thing that I've not seen discussed in anything about the current movies.
Right.
It's that this is eugenics. Like, there's an idea that, like, whatever the fuck that phrase, the Kwisatz Haderach, I've never been able to remember it.
It's, I don't know, man.
It's what they call the Messiah, the Magic Boy. And there's magic this boy. There's this prophecy that the Magic Boy will eventually come around. However,
right.
The prophecy was created by the Bene Gesserit, which is this basically order of nuns throughout the universe. They have spread this prophecy to every world. They have cultivated these messiahs through every noble house in the universe. They have a possible messiah in every single noble house in the universe that they have cultivated. And we're introduced to that idea in this movie with Fade Rautha,
right.
Who's the Sting character from the Lynch movie.
Oh, man.
So, like, it's... They treat it like magic, but it's not magic. It's eugenics. They have been...
Yeah, it's a grift.
They have been selectively breeding their own messiah for 90 generations. And it's just... Through every single noble house. And it's just whichever one happens to come up at the right time that can be brought to heal. And Paul comes up. And he's got all the abilities that they intentionally bred into him. He's not a messiah. He's not a magic destiny-born child. He is someone that was created through selective breeding specifically by this order of nuns, basically.
Yeah, these fucking creeps.
Yeah, and he's like this fucking awesome dude, but like every other house... also has a fucking awesome dude that
he's
was like trained
that,
and
that's
and,
actually
yeah
oh sorry
I was just gonna say that like there's this that doesn't get hit very hard in discussions of Dune, that the messiah component, the destiny component of Dune is entirely manufactured, like,
oh, yeah.
To the point where in this movie Paul starts to become too defiant, like he has all the abilities they want him to have, but he won't be brought to heal. Like, he wants to free the Fremen. He wants to be a revolutionary. He wants to be a leader of men.
Right.
So they're like, well, fuck it. We'll just move over to Fade Rautha from House Harkonnen, who is the other messiah they've been training at House Harkonnen. Yeah, and he's just a fucking
off.
Maniac. Like, so it's just like, they don't care who it is.
No.
It's just whoever is going to follow their directions. So it's...
whoever they can control.
This aspect of it is completely absent from the David Lynch version. Like, it's only ever treated like prophecy and destiny. I mean, the subtext is there because it's there in the novel.
Right. That's funny, though, because I think the fact that it's a false prophecy is extremely
It's a self-fulfilling
important.
Prophecy. It's not It's not only that it's a false prophecy, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
Like,
they
it's designed
it.
To be that way. Like, the Bene Gesserit are the puppet masters in this film. Yeah. Like, it's clear that they are.
Frank Herbert clearly stole this from 2002's The Matrix Reloaded.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, where they also do a false prophecy with Neo, the idea that he's part of a larger system, which I do. I love that idea. Like, this special boy is actually just business as usual. It also actually explains a little bit about... So Dune 1, my other issue with it is I don't really like Paul. And watching this one, I'm like, oh, I'm not supposed to like Paul. Got it.
Yeah, it's like, a little like the first one. I think it's a better movie because it takes its time. It doesn't do the confusing time jumps. It really lets you live in this universe and the characters. But Paul is pretty flat. Like, a lot of the characters are pretty flat because we don't get their motivations yet.
Right, because, well, it is an Act One movie, which, again, that's fine. I feel like, I mean, when you go back and look at, like, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship, great movie, But when you look at it like on the big scale, you're like, not really much happens in that fucking movie. Like, they just sort of walk to they get everything set up.
Disagree. Well,
what I mean is it's all kind of set up, right? It's like, all right, we farm the fellowship, then they fuck off and they go to the mountain.
There's an arc that's represented by Boromir. There is an arc.
There's
an arc to the Pull of the Ring that's represented by
where, like, each Aragorn film has an arc. Decides at the Aragorn, end, like, I can't. Yep, no, I'm not saying that. Like, and there's an arc in Dune 1 too. You know, I'm saying, like, you can get that feeling where you're like, okay, a lot of this movie is set up.
Yeah,
but like. It's kind of the Marvel trap, right? Which is that Marvel will spend so much time on origin, sometimes they'll forget to make a movie. See Web, Madam.
See, I think the difference there is they're so concerned with spewing out the lore, whereas this is it's lore, but we're also getting character and conflict info. Like, every piece of information we get is something about the conflict between Atreides and Harkonnen.
Yes.
Like,
and when we talk about this stuff, I'm not talking about it as why the movie doesn't work, because the movie works. It's more of like, this is a big challenge for the movie. You know what I mean? Like, these are the things they had to navigate. And I think Dune, like the first one, that was a big thing to navigate, which is that, like, there's a reason David Lynch saw all of that movie and said, that's act one. Because for most movies, that would be act one. But we're doing big space fucking epic. We're doing lore. We're fucking stuffing you with shit. And it's based off a book.
It was also partially, I have to believe that, you know, because David Lynch wasn't anyone when he made Dune in 1980.
Oh, yeah, that they didn't let him make more movies.
He was probably told, make this, like, this book is movie one. The next books are movies 2, 3, 4, 5, et cetera. Like, they were trying to make a franchise out of Dune, so they probably told him to make the first movie, to make the first book into a self-contained movie, but also leave room for a sequel.
Right, and I think ultimately it's so much better, because the big thing that Dune 1 does to me is it created that gasp when Chani overheard him say, like, I'm going to marry someone else, because Dune 1 is all setting up. A lot of it is like, I keep, you know, this woman, I'm seeing her.
And he's like, only you think, good. Like, he's pure good. Like, his characterization is so limited in the first movie that he's just a hero. And Jessica is also, just a hero. Like, you're just on their side.
And it's setting up this love story that you kind of assume is going to be a big deal. And then it's just fucking cut off in this one.
Yep.
He basically goes, like, later. And it's like, wow, Jesus. Fuck you. Yeah. And so, like, it really, I don't know, it really worked for that. Again, it's the character stuff. We haven't even talked about the fucking.
And he keeps trying to, too, during that scene.
Yeah.
Like, he keeps trying to maintain the connection. It's such good filmmaking, and it's really good performance, too.
When everybody bows, except for
Chani and the Empress and him.
Yeah, it was just like, fuck! Like, I love triangle right there.
Such good filmmaking. Well, just during that fight where he keeps looking over at Chani.
Yeah.
And it's the looks on his face are never, like, very obvious, but it's always like he's just maintaining. Remember what I just told you? I'll love you until I stop breathing. Remember I just told you? Like, at the beginning of the scene, he takes her aside and says, I will love you until I stop breathing.
Right, because he knows he's about to do something.
Right, he goes in front of the emperor and says, give me your daughter's hand in marriage or I'm going to fuck you up.
Right. He should have talked to her a little more. Been like, this is what I'm going to do.
But he's not going, because again, it's...
Well, he's a little bit of a prick now.
He's a little god king.
Because doesn't want to talk to her about it because he doesn't want her input. Like, he doesn't care what she has to say.
He doesn't need it. He's becoming the god king.
Because
yeah.
What if she says, no, you shouldn't do that? It's like, well, too fucking bad.
I want to hear it. I've made my decisions. He drinks. This is all, in fairness, this is all after he drinks, like, the water of life, which is just like worm piss or whatever.
It's worm jizz, yeah.
That, like, nukes your brain and makes you see colors or taste colors, rather.
I love that shit where it's like, that's like, there's theories about, like, when ancient cultures did a lot of sacrifices and stuff, the idea that they were just eating, like, like mushrooms that were hallucinogenic and didn't realize it, or like food that was spoiled, where it's like, it's all just people tripping. Like,
yeah,
that's it. And I love that Dune is also just people on drugs, basically.
Yeah. Just, it's like when you read about like Joan of Arc and you're like, kind of sounds like a lady with epilepsy.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like all of Dune could be solved if like someone detoxed them all and they're like, yeah, wait, what are we doing? Wait, no. What? What is this shit? I was going to fight you with knives? No. Let's just fucking, I don't know, build a society and have like stores and money and stuff. That's easier. But they went the hard way. Did you notice that he names himself after a desert mouse?
Yes.
And it's Muad'Dib. Very like
Paul Muad'Dib.
Yeah, he does it to sort of show like, you know, I'm not a big deal. So you could say he's a modest mouse. He could have called himself Modest Mouse, Tom. Yeah, I would have preferred that. They should have called him Modest Mouse, is my point. End of that joke.
No, it's perfect. Perfectly executed.
Modest Mouse. I want to talk about the filmmaking because that's another big part.
Yeah.
Because I kept thinking...
It's great.
The thing that breaks my brain is I always keep thinking, like, what makes this better? And I know, you know, you could analyze it and stuff, but like,
two things.
For example, yeah, the movie is all CG, and like, mm-hmm, I've had a lot of movies that were all CG that I'm like, I hate this. And one of the big reasons I hated it was because it was so much CG.
Well, not all of it. They're not, it's not The Mandalorian. They're not standing in a warehouse in front of green screens.
That's a big part, one. But there are scenes where it's like, I guarantee.
Yes. Yeah.
But like the things that matter, like the fighting and stuff, aren't done with CGI. But the main thing is that, and like we've talked about this before, it doesn't really matter how you do it. It's how you present it. Meaning that like when he rides that fucking sandworm, I hear they did make like a rig that he got on, but like, come on, it's mostly CGI. What makes that work is like the pure fucking gravity of it, where it's not like, you know, I guess Legolas jumping on that horse, which isn't supposed to be a big deal, but like, you know what I mean? Where it's the
it's a weird shot now.
I know, it's a weirdo shot, but you know what I mean? Where it's like, they treat it with like, it's a big process. They show every little detail of it. They show it from his perspective where he can't see a fucking thing. It's unpleasant. It's loud. They're really like giving us the full experience. It takes a while, where it's like, this is a long drawn out scene. And I think that's mostly the secret to, you know, using CGI with this stuff, is he makes these shots that are, number one, gorgeous.
Yes,
gorgeous.
They're so, it's...
like the part where they're all like floating up the mountain. And I looked at that and I was like, I bet this is all CGI and it's gorgeous. It's like a painting.
It's so good. And also the sound design. It's the Sadukar, I think. It's the Emperor's Assassins. It's the Emperor's Army.
Right.
They have these jetpacks that are totally silent. And yes, it's really creepy. And they're like spiders in the movie.
Yeah.
It's like watching a spider ascend
and
descend,
the movie knows,
and it's
that
fucking creepy,
right? And so that's the other side of it, is like giving things kind of the surreal nature and gravity that they deserve, where I feel like we don't get enough, considering how weird our movies have gotten conceptually.
It's
weird to me that the movies themselves aren't weird enough.
It's nice.
And so this movie, the music's weird and epic. It's just
I want to talk about something about the music too, but I want to say something about the filmmaking. Is that Denis Villeneuve is one of those filmmakers who you would want this from a filmmaker who is more in tune with the emotion of the film.
Yes.
He's not making an epic. He's not choosing his shots for what is going to look awesome, which is the difference between him and Game of Thrones. Like,
yeah, he's
picking a shot
convey...
of Daenerys getting off a dragon and having the dragon put its wings up behind her so it looks like she has dragon wings. He's not that fucking basic. Like, he is concerned with, like, emotion and spectacle. And so the shot selection and the sound design, just, like I said...
He knows when to scale it back.
Exactly.
The fight at the end, there's no music. There's barely... It's just the sounds of them. Or like the first shot. It's not technically the first shot, but it's the first shot that isn't like the dream sequence. It's his face. And did you notice it's a one-er? It's like his face and they're behind this dune
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, there's the dune. It's the dune. But like they're behind the dune and they, it keeps like rack focusing to show like the activity behind him and like kind of turns. And then it finally cuts to the, like the reverse shot and there's activity behind her. And it's this very like simple, small,
right. Shot. And it's the idea of everything the Fremen talk about too. And I'm sure this is, yeah. It's not just because it looks cool and it's not just for efficiency, although both of those things are true. It's also thematic because the Fremen keep hammering in about how like everything is about, their whole way of life is about being part of the process.
Right.
And being invisible in the process. Like you die, your water gets returned to their little sacred basin. Like you just become part. It's narration that begins the film. Right. It's Chani explaining how the Fremen learned how to survive in the brutal desert. And it's just they learned how to embrace the desert and just be part of the desert's processes, a part of the desert's change, a part of the life chain flow or whatever. So right. That is totally thematic with that, like a oneer showing them like buried in the sand, getting ready to do their raid or whatever, and like sweeping around, keeping the rat focus on everything. It's just, it's like being dropped in the middle of a river or being dropped in the middle of a process that's already
it's in
motion.
Of a tense scene. That's like that's like in the middle of a tense scene, you'd have those close-ups too, because what they're doing is also tense. So it like, it immediately draws you in.
Yeah.
It like, you're like really like, and you, the you whole movie is kind of crafted this way where it's like, what do you ultimately is the difference between this and Rebel Moon, which I keep bringing up again because it's like space opera trying to be very similar.
I'll tell you real quick, just based on what I just said, what you just said, and that question you just posed, I think this movie does a better job of making the audience feel like a drop in the ocean.
Yes.
If that makes, like, you feel like you've been dropped in and you're part of this process and you're moving along and you're seeing the faces, you're seeing the things, you're seeing the conflict. Rebel Moon is not concerned with, the big difference I think between this and Rebel Moon is Rebel Moon is not concerned with the people that live in its universe. This movie is all about the people that live in its universe. It's nothing without them.
It's also, I would argue, a little more simple than that, which is that Rebel Moon doesn't know how to show something is awesome. And what I mean by that is like the first shot of Rebel Moon, or one of the first shots that I remember, is it was space, giant portal, and then this big dick spaceship goes through, right? In this wide. And the spaceship doesn't look big. It doesn't look big in that shot because he wants to show the whole spaceship going through that portal. And it's like a very basic shot. You compare that to when
Star Wars.
Yeah,
with the impossible crawl of the Star Destroyer showing the insurmountable power of the Empire in the first image of the film.
Right, or compare that to this movie where the big gold the big ball ship comes in, and they don't show the whole thing. It's like a piece of it, and they're just showing the re-entry where it's like burnt, you know, there's this flames around it, and the music is so intense, and it's just like you feel this gravity of this moment, of this ship that you know is going to be like important going in. And the ship always looks a little weird. It's always floating over it. It seems like kind of a sinister presence. And like, and then that's not even the first shot. The first shot again is like, the first shot I believe is the baby in the womb, which is like a really fucking surreal, weird shot. And those shots were done with these like weird isolated like darkness around it where it's like, it's beautiful and kind of horrific. And like, it really comes down to like,
I think it's meant to invoke the 2001 baby.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's like just a baby in a womb. I've never seen it done in such a like haunting way. And like this movie knows how to do those like just little haunting moments, or like how to make a shot look big, you know, like the way they're simply framing these machines, or we'll only see pieces of them when we're like, there'll be wides. Don't get me wrong, but when they're first introduced, it's usually like a piece of it in a way that makes you go like, what am I looking at? Like, what is that? And it creates this like mysteriousness and creepiness to everything. Like that big sand fucking mite, that tick that like comes down and has little arms and shit. Like when we first see that, we see it like detaching in this really weird shot that you're not quite sure what you're seeing. Stuff like that. Like, he just knows how to present these very weird things and make them weird and make them feel foreign and like make the tech feel like it makes sense in the world, but is like definitely very alien to us, you know? It's hard to completely, like, there's a formula to it, you know what I mean? It's just like, I think about this all the time with other movies where it's like, they'll have like a very weird idea, but they'll present it in a very non-weird way. And it's like, come on, man. Like, you have like this really cool concept and you're not doing much with it. Or it's just like a device with a blue light. You know what I mean? Where it's like a lot of sci-fi is just like, just make it like this metal kind of metallic device.
Have, like, just some make blue it be like a thing out. That like scans you. Like, no, like, yeah. Make it be like a weird alien creep.
Make it fucking weird. Like, you know, like Doctor Strange, that fucking cube they have is like so standard issue magic tech where it's like, why not be weirder with this stuff? I don't know. And Dune dares to be extremely weird with what is like could have been presented as a pretty straightforward sci-fi story. And that is huge. I think a big reason the audience respond to it is because they genuinely just haven't seen anything like this. Like that black and white arena scene where it's like, this is just the planet.
I liked that a lot.
These inky fireworks.
I liked that, like, the sun is different on Getty Prime, the Harkonnen homeworld.
Right.
Their fireworks that just look like the ink and that's the same as like the ink in the Bacta tank that fucking Stellan Skarsgård is in.
And it's like, that's so fucking weird. I haven't seen that before.
It was
that's
cool.
Awesome.
It was cool having the sun like the light and vibe of the world be different. Like, even just having the sun be that different kind of light sort of almost made you like understand for a second why the Harkonnens are the way they are. Like, you see the light, the sun in that world when they cut to that scene. You're like, oh, I get it. Where they are.
Yeah, I'd be evil too. That's
I'd be like a fucking weirdo if this was like whatever outside looked like every day.
That'd
be terrible.
Yeah. 100%. I go outside, look at the sun. I'd be like, I want to kill something.
He's great, by the way.
Kill something.
Austin Butler as Fade Rautha.
He was a lot of fun.
He's doing a lot of to-do was made about his Elvis voice when he was up for Best Actor last year.
Right.
Or the year before, whenever it was.
I never saw that movie, so.
It's good. He's very good in it. And he couldn't drop the voice for a while afterward, whether that was intentional, like to keep it in critics' minds for Oscars, or whether he legitimately couldn't drop the voice is up for debate. But he seems to be a very good mimic. And I say all of this to point out that he is doing a Stellan Skarsgård impression in this movie when he speaks, and he sounds fucking exactly like him. It's incredible. And it's also a good performance. It's not just he's a good mimic, it's a good performance.
It's like, also a really good character setup.
He's just fucking great in this movie.
Well, like the first time you see him, he goes out basically to do this arena fight.
Yeah. It's and his like birthday, you immediately he's gonna go kill a bunch of slaves in the arena,
and you immediately see like, oh, they drugged the slaves. He has the fucking shield on. Oh, this is bullshit.
Yeah, it's bullshit.
And then basically, Stellan sends out a non-drugged slave, and he picks up on it and realizes like, oh, I see what you fucking want. And he takes off
he
the
turns
shield.
The shield off, yeah.
And so like what you see, it's very good way of doing it because what he's doing in that moment is technically brave. But
he's establishing the villain. He's establishing Fade as a genuine threat to Paul. Like,
exactly.
So when
as
Paul has
person
to fight
with
him
integrity.
At the end of the movie, you're like, oh, fuck.
Right. Like, and he's
yes,
a guy
as
with,
a person
integrity.
With integrity.
But
a level of integrity.
That's what I was about to say.
A level of honorific integrity.
They've lowered the bar in the scene. So it's like the bar is, I don't want to fight drugged up slaves with a shield on. And you're like, good for you. But it's like, yeah, no shit, man.
No,
like,
the conflict is he did kill the drugged up slaves with the shield
on. He does.
He didn't want to fight the guy who wasn't drugged with the shield. Right. Like, he wanted to fight that guy fair.
Right. And so it's like gives him this honor that's still like scummy, basically, which I love. And then it makes him like feel very immediately like dangerous. And I loved that.
And they pointed out too, like one of the Bene Gesserit says, like they point out his flaws. They're like, he's weak in honor and something else, but it was, they pointed out the things that like could be used against him, and it was like the things we just saw in that scene.
Yeah, sex. They say sex.
Yeah, right. His sex is his weakness. That's what Lea Seydoux. She is in this movie. Yeah,
she is.
Briefly. Anya Taylor-Joy is in a single scene.
Also playing a real creep. They're all real creeps.
Yeah, it's just, man, what a character. It's a shame that, I mean, he gets killed. Like it's a Sting character. Like he doesn't do much and then he just kind of dies. So it's a shame that the character gets dispatched so quickly.
But I think that's the point, right? They do so much work.
It's the point. It's the point is to show this fearsome, insurmountable dude that they've been breeding to be another possible messiah, and Paul just fucking beats his ass.
Right. It's also the point of like I feel like that we see so many mini bosses, and like, you know, Marvel will always have, like, especially in the origins, they have the one-off villain, right?
Yeah.
And like oftentimes I think they give it to like a famous actor, and they usually say like
Spider-Man and Green Goblin. It's like, well, you burned Willem right there.
Right. And they usually tell them like, go nuts, you know?
Yeah.
Just do a big performance. And so like, that's essentially what's happening here. But what I think works really well is they also show just how purely fucking formidable he is, on how, you know, like you fully expect him to be a more major villain based on how much they're setting him up. And I like
that. Yeah, and how much ass he whoops.
Yeah, because you'd think like this is a guy they would set up in the first movie, right? But
it's weird that
he's glad
not
they didn't
in it.
I get it, honestly, because I think this movie needed, like we're saying, these movies need to be technically self-contained as movies.
Yeah.
So it's like I think they felt like they needed to introduce a threat to up the ante in this movie the way a sequel would.
I might have introduced him in the last one. I don't know where you would have done it.
Maybe teased him or something.
I think you would have just put that arena scene in at some point in the first movie to be aware that.
Right.
But of course, they were also slow trickling the reveal that Paul is but one cog in the overarching scheme of the Bene Gesserit to produce manufacture a messiah. I don't know. Right. It feels like he should have been introduced earlier, because he's introduced at the hour mark in this movie.
Yeah.
And then he dies like 90 minutes later. So it's brief in terms of the storyline.
Right. Yeah, it's a bit brief, but I think
it's very consequential, yeah.
Yeah, and it fucking, I don't know, it left an impact, you know, because they make it
right.
Count.
It's like one of those things where it's I think ultimately the thing I'm wrestling with is we're not going to see him in any more Dune movies, and I'm like, yeah, fuck, he was so good. He was so much fun.
He was great. Like, there's a lot of fun in this.
He was
this.
Really good, yeah.
Batista was very fun in this.
Yeah,
he didn't
Batista,
have as much to do.
But they did give him something in this movie that makes his performance in the first movie like hit a little bit harder too. Like you get that we learn that he's the older brother between him and Fade in this movie, that he is the perennial failure. He's always had the reputation of being the failure between the two of them. So like his quiet in the first movie, he has a lot of quiet moments that explode into rage. That are treated fearsomely in the first movie.
Yeah.
And then in this movie, we see those same moments and we understand them because we learn that he's wrestling with this, the weight of this, just this reputation that he has with his family of being the black sheep of a failure. But also we see that his quiet moments boil up and explode into rage. But in this movie, it's impotent. Like, it's not treated as being, like, in the first movie, it's treated as being scary. Like, you're like, oh, fuck, Batista's a guy to be fucked with. Like, he's a dude to be reckoned with, not to be fucked with. In this movie,
he runs away.
It just comes off as weakness.
He's a coward.
Like, it's the same explosions of anger, but it comes off as weakness. You're right. It's like he runs away.
Literally yeah, runs
he
away
literally
from the battle.
Runs away.
And then at the end, he's trying to escape. At the end, he like fucks off and he's like, I'm just going to slip out.
Right. And then like, yeah, Josh Brolin comes up and he's like, motherfucker, we got to fight. And he's like, all right, Gurney, we'll fight. I'm like, dude, get on your spaceship. Don't
right.
fight
don't,
this man.
Right. Like, you're going to lose.
Don't roll those dice. Even if you don't lose, like there's a chance you could lose. Just get on your spaceship.
Just leave. There's like, I don't know if they did this intentionally. There was like a couple line deliveries that more reminded me of Drax. Like when he got angry, it felt like, I wonder if it's because Drax kind of ruined it. Whenever Dave Bautista yells, I think of Drax getting upset and it kind of made me giggle. But like it works in the sense that he's not like
confident.
He's
not confident in the way that Fade is. Like you see a scene
he's
with him and Fade, and it's
he's there to pump up the other guy, so it works.
Yeah,
very good movie.
It's good. It's good.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I have anything else to say about it.
The last thing I wanted to point out was about the music. Hans Zimmer obviously is doing his shit in this movie. Fade's theme is cool. He does a cool thing with the crowd chanting Fade's name, like Fade Rautha. Like there's a rhythm to the way they chant it, and he integrates that into the score he does for Fade's theme. It's similar to what Hans Zimmer did for Dark Knight Rises when they have that chant that becomes part of the score.
Yeah.
It's just really cool. It's a good score.
It's a very
way to go,
score.
Hans Zimmer. You're good when
it's
you show up.
It's an incredible fucking score. Yeah. I mean, this. I can't wait to fucking do work to the Dune 2 soundtrack.
Hell yeah.
You know.
But I'm all done.
I mean, it really comes down to like, again, I didn't even need to ask the question like, what makes this work but other fucking boring ass space epics not work? This is just better. It's better made. It focuses on the characters when other ones don't as much. And it's not boring, even though it's a lot of people talking. It's interesting because you care about the people that are talking in the scene, you know? It's good. It's a good movie.
It's a good movie.
That's it. Yeah.
Pretty solid. Hope they make more. Although he has said that Dune 3 is not his next movie.
No shit. I can see that. He needs to do... I hope it's Prisoners 2. Fuck it.
We need that cinematic universe, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited for that. No rush, though. I get it.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. I approve. So, yeah, thanks for listening, everyone. We're done.
I think we're done.
Listen, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/gameplayunemployed. You go on there for just $5 a month. You get access to exclusive podcasts such as Tom and Jeff Watch Batman, Fox Mulder's a Maniac, Star Trek The Next Futurama, Spiel Boys. We watch movies every Friday night. I think we did watch The Lynch Dune one of those Friday nights.
We have.
I really do.
It's been a while. We could do it again.
We could do it again, but yeah, that's the sort of the vibes of those nights. We have a great Discord community. That's all on patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. Check that out.
Yeah, check it out. We also have a store. Head over to gamefullyunemployed.com where you can find a link to our Teespring store where we have all kinds of cool original artwork and designs you can get on t-shirts, mugs, stickers, posters, all sorts of things. So check that out. Slap your spice harvesting peepers onto that.
Yeah, those spicy peeps.
Those spicy peeps.
Spicy peeps.